I'll call to order the House Committee on Environment and Water for Thursday, April 9th, 2009, and open a public hearing on House Bill 2539. Sorry, we're going to be jumping around on the agenda, and we're beginning at the bottom. Representative Shields and any of the guests that you'd like to bring up with you to help introduce the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chip Shields, State Representative, District 43, North and Northeast Portland. I appreciate you hearing this bill today. I've instructed everyone to keep their testimony to 3 minutes or less so that we can help you get on to other business.
Does that include you, Representative?
No, I have an exemption, what we call diplomatic immunity.
All right. I won't turn this on.
House Bill 2539 with the Dash 1 amendments limits the purchase of fireworks and the use of fireworks to the time period around the 4th of July for cities over 300,000, and essentially that's the city of Portland at this point. And Portland representatives are amending state law rather than city ordinance because the city fire marshal at the city of Portland suggested that it was more appropriate for this to be in state law since fireworks regulation generally is under the state fire marshal's purview. Currently, Oregon law only restricts the sale of fireworks, not their use. And this bill would prohibit the use of fireworks to the period of June 30th to July 5th. Now, why is that important? Well, I appreciate the fun and patriotic nature of fireworks. Used them all my life as a kid. But in my district, fireworks have truly become a nightmare. They begin about 4 weeks prior to the 4th of July and end about 4 weeks after it. And this affects humans and animals in the following ways. Number one, fireworks start fires, and Commissioner Randy Leonard will be here to talk a little bit more about that. Also, you should have in front of you a letter from Eva Kutas, whose house was burnt down due to fireworks, and she lives right across the street from me.
Across the street from where?
From me. This was before we moved into the neighborhood. Fireworks, number two, fireworks are often confused for gunfire in my district, unfortunately, where gang crime and gunfire are far too common. The constant use of fireworks for weeks on end around the 4th of July and New Year's make it difficult for the police and citizens to differentiate between real shots fired calls from residents and false alarm calls that are actually fireworks, not gunfire. In other words, fireworks are bad for police and public safety. Number three, fireworks traumatize dogs and other domestic pets. And I'm sending around a letter from the Oregon Humane Society indicating their support for this bill. Fireworks are bad for dogs. Number four, fireworks traumatize our veterans. I'm sending around emails from therapists who treat the men and women who have bravely served our country in foreign wars. Fireworks can inflame combat stress and post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms, and Paul Evans from the governor's office, his Veterans Affairs Director, will talk more about that. And now that I have a one-year-old daughter, Mr. Chair, I fear that as we come up on the 4th of July, that the constant barrage of fireworks in our district will consistently startle her. Now, opponents of the bill that you'll hear from have a legitimate argument in that a significant part of the problem in Portland surround illegal fireworks, most of which are brought in from Washington. But since most people don't know the law and don't distinguish between legal and illegal fireworks, we think this bill makes sense to educate the public and send a strong message to Portlanders that all fireworks can only be exploded or used from June 30th to July 5th, and remind them in a systematic way that fireworks are only allowable in this window because they do more damage than otherwise you might suspect. Mr. Chair, I will now hand it over to my constituent, Lisa Hamid, who is one of the many constituents of mine that asked me to please do something about out-of-control fireworks in our district.
Thank you, Representative.
Good afternoon, Chairman Cannon and members of the Environment and Water Committee. My name is Lisa Hamid, and it is a great honor for me to participate in this legislative process. I want to thank you for your attention to my concerns. I know you have a copy of my statement, so I'm not going to reiterate it, and Representative Shields has done a wonderful job of encapsulating it. You'll notice I have my tiger. This is a stuffed animal, and it's just to remind you that this is really a concern that affects the animals, domestic and wild, the protected raccoons. I'm a bird watcher, and I know, although I'm not an ornithologist, I know that the birds are really traumatized, like Representative Shields said, from the moment the fireworks stands come out. I know that I'm going to have random explosions. Some of my colleagues at work suggested that I make banging noises during this testimony randomly. I'm not going to do that, but just the very thought gives you the idea. It's an open season of fireworks, cherry bombs, bottle rockets, and the like, explosions which can be thrown into the street. And what I think is brilliant of Representative Shields is not to try to outlaw fireworks. I think that would be unreasonable. But to define and establish a fireworks season. And for that, I thank you very much for your consideration. And that's what I hope to get out of this.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Evans.
Chair Cannon, members of the committee, for the record, I am Paul Evans. I'm a policy advisor to Governor Kulongoski for military and veterans issues. I'm actually not testifying in that capacity, but rather as a veteran of 10 overseas contingencies, including time in Central and South America in the drug war, the Bosnian mission, Iraq twice, and Afghanistan once. I'm not generally one to suggest that the government should get involved in a lot of personal opportunities to have fun and do those things. But I was asked a very straightforward question. Do the sounds of fireworks, especially the unexpected sounds coming at unexpected times, do they have an impact? They do. And my situation is I would suggest fairly mild compared to a number. I'm not here to tell you that every veteran has an issue with that. I will tell you that the unexpected nature of loud bombs or whistles certainly do have a traumatic effect at times, and that they can sometimes provide some embarrassing moments that you wish you could take back. If there is a way to confine that activity to a specific period of time, I know around our house anyway, it would be certainly appreciated. This bill does not affect a metropolis of 8,000 as much as it does 300,000, but it is a real issue. And you know, for those that have had to listen to me talk about veterans' issues for a long time, the impact upon the Iraq-Afghanistan vets especially, though smaller in number compared to previous generations, the impact of 2 and 3 tours, especially with the impact of improvised explosive devices, if there is a reasonable way to make sure that we can lessen the impact on them, I think that that is a good thing. Anyway, that's all I have to say. I'd certainly try to answer any questions you have from my experience.
Thank you very much. Representative Shields, can you talk about Section 2? Having trouble making my way through on the Dash 2 amendments. There are a few changes on page 2 between lines 7 and 13. I think I understood that the only change that was made in Section 1 to the original bill was a slight variance on the dates. But then what's going on here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is happening in lines 7 through 13 is trying to sync up the sale dates for fireworks and the use of fireworks. So a permit shall authorize sales. Basically, what they're adding language about outside of a city with a population of 300,000 to make sure that the June 22nd to July 6th, which is currently in law as the window, is just clarified that for if you're outside the city, that window still stays in place, that we're only changing it for in line 11, a population of 300,000 or more, the 30th to the 12th. But again, it made sense that to have a sale and a use in sync with each other rather than having them at odds with each other.
Okay. I think that's helpful. Let me see if there are questions from other members of the committee. Representative Bernhardt.
Would you be open to amending the bill to add the largest city in Lane County? I'm wondering, let me be less facetious, I'm wondering why you limited it to the city of Portland.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I felt there was such a tremendous problem in the city of Portland that I knew of. I wasn't sure how this affected other municipalities, and I didn't want to be presumptuous. I'm open to that. I think particularly if it was unanimous in the views of your other representatives of that area, I think that's also, frankly, a concern of the opponents, but I'll let them express that.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what's wrong with the unincorporated areas of our and to be serious on what Paul has indicated, that and in my district I have a lot of veterans and a lot of recent veterans, and I worry about them just as much who live in the rural areas as those who do outside or inside Portland city limits. And I think that this, if we're going to make policy like this, in our Veterans Committee, we've been very careful to make a veteran a veteran a veteran. You know, it doesn't matter where you live, who you are. If you're a veteran, you're a veteran. And treat everybody the same.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, I think this is the opening salvo of the discussion. I do want to talk to the opponents and see if there's some common ground. They've indicated that there may be. And if that's the case, we could amend the bill in a variety of ways, and I'd be very open to that.
Follow-up. And it would be remiss to not mention the fire danger. We experience that in both, even on the beach, the homes along the beach grass. Mm-hmm. We always have fires on 4th of July because of the horizontal rockets.
And Commissioner Leonard will be addressing some of those as well.
Representative Smith.
Yeah, those are that's related to the question I had, which is, do we have any data on fire danger this has caused, in particular, not just in Portland area, which is obviously the only town that's bigger than 300,000 at this point in our state, and to the extent people have appetite to think about this statewide, I could even imagine fire danger being more extensive if you're east of the Willamette Valley, where there's less rainfall, and or you have foliage that's more connected to more nearby foliage rather than broken up by more concrete. So I have sort of fire questions.
I'll let Mr. Evans respond to that.
Chair Cannon, Representative Smith, I'm sure that Commissioner Leonard is going to go into much more detail on this, but by happenstance, I was down at Sisla Fire and Rescue last Friday looking at a potential site for an emergency management pre-deployment warehouse facility where, in case of tsunami and things like that, we could put things there. But on the way, Chief Buchanan was actually bringing up on his own talking about the fire season along the coast and the frustration he has with, he absolutely favors, because all firefighters, I think, when I was a volunteer firefighter, I loved fire, but in a controlled situation. And the concern he always has in his particular community, because of the way in which the houses are up among the forest and the areas, that the uncontrolled burns that happen every year because of irresponsible use of fireworks. I mean, I know that there's evidence outside the city of Portland as well, and I know the Fire Chiefs Association probably could put that to you fairly quickly.
My semi-facetious suggestion that I made earlier to Representative Shields was I'd be more inclined to support the bill if the ban was on the week of July 4th when I try to get out of town. And
how do you feel about America generally?
maybe it is a city of Portland thing, but it is, and I believe that to a certain extent, maybe a large extent, what I'm experiencing are fireworks that were not purchased in Oregon and aren't, in fact, legal within Oregon. But it is dangerous. It is loud. It is uncomfortable. I really appreciate you bringing forward this bill, Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's so many astounding things about this bill to me.
Think of Snowball.
Pardon me?
Think of Snowball.
Okay. Let the record show he started it. The first is, you send a guy Eastern Oregon one time and he advocates for the other part of our state, and I'm very impressed by that.
A bit more than once.
But if you already explained this part, Representative, pardon me, but I'm a slow learner, as you know. We want to do this for the city of Portland. Your bill calls for the city of Portland. Why aren't we, and we have a commissioner, and I don't mean to be in any way rude because we're eager for you to talk, but just to quickly ask you, why aren't we looking to the commissioner for the first step in this at the City of Portland as an ordinance, and then talking about the rest of the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, that's a great question. We had thorough discussions with legal counsel at the city. We had thorough discussions with the fire marshal. And the thought is that since fireworks generally are regulated by the state fire marshal's office, that it made more sense to for the regulatory framework to have all of those things residing at the state rather than having them broken up into city ordinance blocks. It could have been done that way. It was just the city fire marshal's view that it made more sense to do it at the state level.
Okay, follow up.
Hello.
Okay, and I did hear you right at the beginning, and I apologize, but I want to go over that again. I mean, just so you know how I feel, I would come to the opposite conclusion, regardless of the fact that the relationship to the state marshal. If you want to do this for the city, I think we should start in the city. If you want to do it for the state, that's a different discussion.
That's a fair criticism, and we'll keep it under consideration.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do, and there are some cities in my district who have banned fireworks. So it does happen city by city. They're small, granted, but they're still cities.
Hmm. With that, let me invite Commissioner Leonard to...
Yeah, and I'll stay till the end in case there are any more
great
questions.
And Jerry Farley as well, if you could join. But we'll start with the commissioner. Yeah, why don't you? Yeah, yeah. It's just those are the only other two people signed up to testify, so we'll have room for both. Commissioner?
Thank you for having me, and I want to thank Representative Shields first for introducing this legislation. My name is Randy Leonard. I'm a member of the Portland City Council. But before arriving on the council, I did serve 25 years in the Portland Fire Bureau as an active firefighter. When I left in 2002, I was at the position of a fire lieutenant. And in Portland, of course, we have a unique form of government where the members of the city council are assigned bureaus to administer, and I am the commissioner in charge of the Portland Fire Bureau. Chair Cannon and members of the committee, as a former firefighter, I do know firsthand the danger that fireworks pose to the community, and I thank you for taking the time to consider this very important piece of legislation. House Bill 2539 would limit the times in which it is legal to set off fireworks to the period between July 1 and July 8 in cities with populations greater than 300,000. The July 4th holiday is a good example of the costs and dangers that fireworks pose to fire departments and communities, but these problems are hardly limited to the period surrounding July 4th. While it is clear that the problem of fireworks related the problem of fireworks related fires is more acute in the period surrounding July 4th, it continues to cause a significant problem throughout the year. In 2008, for an example, of 63 fireworks related fires, 41 or 65% of those fires occurred outside of the period between July 1st and July 8th. In 2007, out of 99 fireworks related fires, 36 of them occurred outside of that period. Even when fireworks do not result in fires or other immediate problems, they provide a nuisance and disruption in urban areas by creating waste and noise. In addition to disturbing residents and frightening pets, fireworks can affect air quality and contaminate surrounding bodies of water. By limiting the period in which fireworks can be used to the week surrounding the July 4th holiday, we can reduce the number of fires and spare the community of an unnecessary danger while still allowing Portland residents to celebrate the 4th of July in a manner consistent with tradition. This will provide limit the dangers that fireworks pose to the community during the rest of the year. I offer my support of House Bill 2539, and I appreciate you having me today and considering this bill.
Thanks. Before we move on, let's see if there are any questions for Commissioner Leonard. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, thanks for coming down.
Thank you.
Just a quick question for you to the extent that you're able to answer it. We heard earlier the question, the issue of illegal fireworks raised, and I'm just curious from your perspective, if having a moratorium on all fireworks during the majority of the year would help law enforcement focus in on regulating some of those illegal fireworks as well and put them out.
I think it would. I mean, it oftentimes becomes a little confusing, particularly given that the effect of our fireworks laws is the police officers enforce those laws, and they don't always necessarily distinguish between legal and illegal fireworks the way a firefighter would. I think it would be helpful to have just an entire ban so you knew that all of them were not proper.
Representative Smith.
I just want to say thanks. Commissioner Leonard, you served me the courtesy when I testified before you not too long ago. You are the commissioner on the council that I think is perhaps most attentive to unconstitutionally annexed Mid-County, and appreciate your leadership on those.
And how do you feel about the annexation?
How many years ago was that?
I don't know. I was born then. Yeah. Right. I was graduating from high school.
It includes some of my district too. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for Commissioner for being here and giving your time today.
It's always a pleasure to see you, Representative Jensen.
Great to see you, Commissioner Leonard, and I go back to time of serving together in this body, and he always gave me a bad time, so I feel like I have an
opportunity. But I had your back. I always had your back.
That's true, you did.
Yes, I did.
I appreciate that, and appreciate the friendship that we developed. And I would say that I'm inclined to be supportive of the concepts that come with this bill. I would quickly remind the panel, though, that as far as fire danger is concerned, it is not limited to the week before the 4th of July or the weeks after the 4th of July. The week of the 4th of July, fires will also start from fireworks, and from a kind of pretty close personal issue with that, the minister of our church completely lost his home from fireworks on the 4th of July. Mm. The house burned completely to the ground, and it was a relatively new house that at least was not a tinderbox, if you wish. Did have a nice 35-mile-an-hour wind to kind of help it along a little bit. But the danger of fire is always present from fireworks. That's inherent, in it. I would also remind my colleagues here at the dais that the animals that are petrified from fireworks is not confined to the city of Portland either. My current dog, is pretty immune to fireworks, and one would say as a retriever she should be. However, the one I had before her just absolutely went crazy during the weeks of the 4th of July, and she also was a retriever. So I know the problems that, that it causes as far as animals of all sorts, not just dogs, all sorts of animals, a lot of problem, with it. So I'd be very inclined to support this bill. I would, however, say that I have reservations about supporting it if it is just for the city of Portland. It's kind of like the reservations I've had about supporting a bill for photo radar in some of the metropolitan areas. If it's good for the metropolitan areas, I don't know why it's bad for the more rural areas, of the state. And I don't know whether my city would like to use photo radar or not. I don't know whether the citizens of my city would like to have photo radar or not. But they should have the same opportunity and has the same protections, basically, that the citizens of other parts of the state would have, and, the opportunity. So, expressing my support of the ideas and the concepts here, though it would give me heartburn to support it if it was confined just to the city of Portland.
Thank you for those comments.
I wonder if I might just say just a couple things. As a political strategist, I completely understand Representative Shields' approach to try to minimize opposition. My fire professional hat, which included also being certified in the fire code, of which I was a sworn fire prevention officer for a number of years, I couldn't agree more. This should be something that should apply statewide. As you pointed out, those that have actually experienced fire find little romanticism in the rampant use of fireworks when it's destroyed property, killed people and terrified animals. So as usual, I very much agree with your remarks, Representative Jensen. Thank you.
Just quick follow, if I could.
Very quick, and then
okay, I understand the political thing, too, so yeah. I appreciate that. Yeah. But
Representative Barnhart.
Perhaps the political consideration might be the opposite of what Representative Shields thinks it is.
Yeah, I think that it's really, honestly, it's inspiring to hear what's being said. I appreciate it very much.
Mr. Farley, you've been waiting your turn patiently, and let's hear from you. And gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to get back.
And members, we do not have a fiscal on this bill yet, so we won't be moving it today. We may see it on a future agenda.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jerry Farley. I am a representative of a company called American Promotional Events, which is a state-licensed wholesaler of legal fireworks in the state of Oregon. I should tell you that I am not a resident of Oregon, and to be completely honest, I'm a lobbyist in another state, but I have local representation. And when I was a younger man, I was involved in writing the Oregon State Fireworks Law back a few years ago.
Okay.
This is an industry that I've been intimately involved in since 1982, and I'm very familiar with statutes in many states, and obviously, as you probably could surmise, helped write some of them. The difficulty that you have with this bill, and we have with this bill, is a fair balance between the right to celebrate what the 4th of July means with fireworks, as John Adams, in his letter to Abigail, his wife, suggested was something that would be done forevermore, and the public health and safety. I understand that there is a bill and then a proposed substitute. The proposed substitute is substantially more onerous and, I must say, probably much more disastrous for everyone. But let me just speak to that, if I may, for a second. In essence, what it does is it limits sales and use to a very short window. What will the effect of that be? Well, first of all, I guarantee that you will lose control of fireworks. I guarantee that, because prohibitions usually don't work. I can also tell you that groups, and I have a list of groups that my client supplies as a wholesaler in the city of Portland, Faith Chapel, Park Rose Harvest Church, Apostolic Worship Center, Evergreen Community Club, Booster, Heritage High School, Freedom Foursquare Church. I could go on. That's only the first three or four on the list. Many of these will no longer sell fireworks because under the proposed substitute, it will not be profitable for them to do so. So all of the money that they raise and use for their charitable purposes in the city of Portland will be gone. And it's my belief that people who want to use or misuse fireworks, when they can't get what they want locally, will go find it where they can. That's part of your problem you have here in Oregon. At the time we were involved in writing the statute, which is now the Oregon statute, and I must tell you I supported that on behalf of my clients, we decided to draw the line and not allow aerial fireworks in the state of Oregon. Unfortunately for all of us, federally protected enclaves are not subject to state law and therefore can do what they want. And in the business of the marketplace, sometimes you have to do things differently as a result. And so the Washington law was changed to allow more aerial items so that the Washington charitable clubs and organizations could continue to survive. And as you probably know, many of the people go to Washington to buy aerial items that they can't buy in Oregon. So this is a little more complex than the simple solution of just restricting days of use and days of sale. While it's fair to say that...
Mr. Farley, I'm going to ask that you focus on what it is about the Dash Ones that makes this not a bill that you could support, since it
Dash one.
Like the original bill, if I understood correctly, you were okay with? And what is it about the dash ones?
Because of the nature of the business, the dash one version will guarantee that about one-third of the charitable clubs and organizations that sell in the city of Portland will go out of business. And you can extrapolate that to the entire state if you were to expand the coverage. And of the remaining, all of them will lose a substantial portion of their revenue. Because while we all know that the vast majority of sales occur in the last few days, it is not fair to say that all of them do, and many times that makes the difference between profit and no profit. There's another thing that's much more important from my perspective. Fireworks is a once a week or once a year kind of activity. And so every year there are people who never sold the year before, even if it's the same organization. And without those extra days at the front end where they can learn how to do what they're supposed to do and to comply with the regulations that they must comply with, you guarantee that some of them will be out of compliance and there will be difficulties. They may not have their permit where it's supposed to be. They may not have the fire extinguisher where it's supposed to be. Some of the people who work in the stand may not understand certain things that they're supposed to do. The extra days help them learn. And as you, it's like any business. You start a new business, there's a learning curve until the people understand what it is that they're supposed to be doing. And that's why those days are critical. They are not huge in terms of sales, but they are huge in terms of that learning curve at the beginning, particularly when the sales that do occur are a majority in the last several days. So on the face of it, one would think, well, you're not really hurting anybody by changing the number of days. But in fact, you're hurting everybody because the enforcement officials are more likely to encounter problems, and the people selling will know less and therefore not do as good a job. For example, somebody walks up to the stand and says, I want to buy this. And if they didn't have those days, they may not understand. But if they do have those extra days of sale, they may have learned maybe you shouldn't be buying that where you are, or maybe that isn't appropriate for you. And since most of the people that we're talking about are charitable clubs and organizations that use the money in the community, it's fair to say that they have a great deal of concern about the product they sell being used correctly and safely. With all due respect to others, fireworks don't start fires. Fireworks misused or inappropriately used start fires. And so I think the balance that I would find more acceptable in the original bill is that it gives all of us a little more time to know exactly what we're doing. But beyond that, as I told Representative Shields, I think there are other issues that we need to address about a more robust and aggressive public education campaign, in which I believe the industry has a share of that burden. And we have stepped up to that plate in other states, and would do so here. So, and some, Mr. Chairman, dash one is a much more problematic, much more difficult for us.
Okay, and just so I'm perfectly clear about this, and that's because it narrows the window within which sales could occur in the city of Portland to match the period of permitted use.
Right.
Detonation, if you will, of the
fireworks.
Devices.
Consumer fireworks do not detonate.
Okay. My bad. Thank you for the clarification. Thank you very much. Any questions, Representative Boone?
Yeah, I was a little confused about it because it seems like it's a difference of 2 days. The original bill went from July 1 through the 8th. The dash ones are June 30th to the 6th. June 22nd, too.
I think the original bill, the prohibition was July 1 to July 8th. In the dash ones, it's June 30th to July 5th. But the specific objection you have is that the prohibited sale dates in the dash one amendments are June. The allowable sale dates are June 30th to July 5th.
It's July 1st because it's midnight June 30th.
Right, okay. So in essence, someone would not be able to sell their...
But if I may, Representative Boone and Mr. Chairman, the question he asked me is which was better. Well, clearly the original bill is better. But what I would like to say is I'd rather the sales dates stay the same, because the comments I made about people getting... up to speed on what they're doing, the longer period they have. They're not going to have a lot of sales on June 23rd through whatever date. They aren't. That's a fair statement. But the people who are volunteers and have never worked in a stand before or have not worked in a stand for over a year or maybe a year will learn what's new products and what's new regulations if there are any, and will understand better. And secondly, they will be better able to talk to their customers. And then some customers come and look but don't buy. So they'll learn a little bit more. So the whole effect of those extra days of sale is that it's better for, in my opinion, for everybody. It's better for the people who sell. It's better for the people who buy, because everybody becomes a better, more compliant customer.
Briefly, and then we were going to have to move on.
The only reason I said that is because in my world, we deal with fishing seasons that run in hours in some cases.
I know.
So people just, they have the big upfront time where you can't do it, and they know exactly when they can get in the water. So, okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2539. And is Representative Greenlick on his way? Then we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3367. And wait, Representative Greenlick. We are planning to hear all four of these bills today. I will be asking folks to keep their testimony short in order to make that possible, spending probably just committee about 25 minutes per bill as we move through these remaining three. Perhaps less than that on this one, since we only have one other person signed up to testify. Representative, welcome. We've opened the public hearing on your bill, House Bill 3367. I seem to recall hearing a bill like this 2 years ago in the Energy and Environment Committee. I don't recall what happened. Did we pass that bill? And
we did. This is stage two.
Great. Tell us about it.
More has happened. This comes about, as you will remember, I told you the last time, from two impulses. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33.
And I'm going to have a hard time not referring to you as Mr. Chair, serving on your health care committee.
And I appreciate that. I'll have an easy time referring to you as Mr. Chair, if I remember to do so. This the impulse for this bill came about from two places. One day I was at the beach and went out at night on a clear night and looked up and saw an extraordinary exhibit. The stars, the Milky Way. I think some of you from Eastern Oregon won't understand how extraordinary that was.
Extraordinary?
But I just looked up, and it took me back to my childhood. Because frequently you don't have clear nights at the beach, so it's not the easiest thing to do. This was a clear night, and the sky was completely lit up. It was an amazing event to me. I got a chair and I sat there staring at it for a couple of hours until I got too cold. I then came back home and was sitting in my hot tub in Portland, overlooking the city, and looking around and looking up, and I couldn't see any stars. It was a clear night. There were two faint stars showing, and I look out, and what I see is this huge display of light, including a parking lot lit up in northeast Portland, 7 miles away, 6 miles away. I saw these bright lights. So I started looking into this question of light pollution, and I soon discovered it really wasn't only that we were robbing our children of the ability to see the sky, but that there was an extraordinary energy difference in making sense out of this lighting. Now, there are two problems with lighting. Let's say you want to light a parking lot or a stadium or anything else. There are two ways things go bad. The first place, if you want to send light down to here, the obvious thing is to have a unidirectional light down to here. I have pictures of a Hillsborough stadium that's lit up every night. My constituents were complaining about it at the town hall the other day. Totally omnidirectional lighting. The light going everywhere, into the sky and down on the ground and everywhere else. The second problem is you only need to put enough energy down into the light to light the ground to get the light you want on the ground, the number of lumens you want. The more likely thing is to send far more light down to the ground than you need, far more. And the consequence of that, it bounces off the ground up to the sky. So you end up with the omnidirectional lighting standing everywhere and the light bouncing off the ground into the sky. Now, that's a bad thing in its own right. I mean, I think we need to have the skies back. I don't think we need light pollution. But in terms of energy conservation, I started checking with places that have dark sky ordinance. Sandy, Oregon was the first one, I think, in Oregon that did. I talked to them. I talked to the people in Tucson, Arizona. I talked to some other folks, and I began to talk to lighting engineers. And what was clear is that you can save half of the energy by using unidirectional lighting and only sending enough light down to the ground. Half of the energy costs can be saved by doing it the right way rather than the wrong way. So we found out there were some national standards coming up. We passed the last bill, which got the Department of Energy interested in this issue. They supported that bill. They were looking at the international standards that were emerging. And I think you'll hear somebody from the Department of Energy talk to you today. This bill takes this just a little further. It does three things. It gives good choice to consumers by requiring electric utilities that supply fixtures to provide the option of a dark sky shielded fixture as long as the cost, the extra cost of this kind of fixture more than pays for itself in a finite amount of time by energy savings. It outlaws mercury vapor lighting, which is a big problem in this, but is also a problem for lots of other things. So it going forward, it reduces or eliminates the new uses for mercury vapor lighting, which caused not only a problem in terms of being pretty bad, harsh, glary lighting, you've all seen it, but also has a recycling problem in terms of dealing with the mercury in the bulbs. And finally, it gets us into the future by making preferred policy in government building and in public building codes to use this kind of lighting unless there is a significantly less expensive alternative available. Basically, that's all this bill does. It moves us another 10 or 15 yards down the field toward energy conservation. Oh, also, I do need to note, and I'll leave you copies, the Sierra Club has endorsed it. I think you have a letter. PGE supports what we're doing, and I think you'll hear from other people who do as well. I ask you to seriously consider this and to move into work session and move this bill on its way.
Thank you, Representative Greenlick. Representative Smith.
Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks a lot for bringing this bill. It is the thing I like about it is the category it's in is that much of the energy conversation is about new types of energy, which is important, but an under-prioritized area of conversation is how we can save the types of energy that we already use without doing too very much. The concern area I have, the question set that I want to ask is about sort of economic impacts, and I'll just ask that sort of what do we know about the impacts it would have on retailers, wholesalers, producers, individual consumers, as we adjust from a 360 degree light world to a 180 degree light world or whatever.
Well, there isn't anything in here that requires any change in existing lighting, so it's all about going forward and what happens when the analysis is made. For example, the state got into this question in terms of lighting their intersections, now the highway areas, and they found that purchasing what they call cobra head lighting, which is sort of shield lighting that goes down, and for the right degree, simply saves them a ton of money.
Yep.
So the notion is you would expect retailers, and this isn't so much retailers because it's not me as a homeowner going out. I've actually tried to do that. It's not me as a homeowner going out. It's really when you start building buildings and start planning, you expect the suppliers for these activities to begin to have a different kind of inventory.
And last question. I think from the reading of the bill, this corresponds to public lighting purchases as a thing for private lighting purchases, as we already do with LED lights, for instance. Am I reading that right, or does this have some impact on private sector purchases that I'm not aware of?
Well, for example, Section 2 talks about a public utility that provides a customer with outdoor lighting. That would be a private customer. Make options available as a part of that. So in a sense, it's for, I think, public and private.
Okay.
But it's certainly for public buildings, however you define those, which is, I think, more than just government-owned facilities.
Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment to say that if starry skies are where Representative Greenlee gets his inspiration from, then I'm all for having more of them.
Yeah, and not being able to see the stars aggravate me. So,
it's a wonderful topic for this committee. I wish we had more bills related to the night sky. Right? That it's just for an environment committee to be considering such a significant portion of our environment that we, I think, so rarely think about. But love for my daughter to be able to grow up in Portland. At least on occasion, seeing the nighttime sky.
And it's not going to happen in Portland for a while, but I do recommend the committee, given the fact that we have so much extra budget available to us, take a trip out to the Oregon coast on a clear night and join Representative Boone, and she'll show you what it looks like. Or go east. I suspect you must have the same thing if you get into a different time zone. Is that right?
I do. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to point that out, that Representative Greenlee was in my district when he viewed those.
Exactly, exactly right.
Art Morris and Brenda McCarthy and Mark Long? Stephen?
I don't know.
Yeah. We'll wait. We'll wait on Mark. But Art and Brendan, if you would come on forward. Let's hear from Mr. Morris.
Hi, my name is Art Morris, and I'm a member of the Rose City Astronomers. I am the International Dark Sky Association representative or liaison. I am brand new in this job, or I kind of volunteered for it. I didn't know how big it was. And I have a couple of, I have a bunch of brochures here for light pollution and safety, and light pollution and energy, and also what light pollution does for the wildlife. There are, from what I have read, there's a lot of wildlife that's killed because of misdirection caused by lights. I was here to support the bill as it's written. I'd like to see it get tougher over time, because I live above Sherwood on Chehalem Mountain, and I look down and remember 20 years ago when I bought my house up on the hill that I could look down and hardly see any lights between Sherwood and Tualatin. Tualatin-Sherwood Road now is just lit up with these globe lights that you can see, just a pathway all the way through. And City of Sherwood is doing the same thing. They've got just these 360-degree globes, and it's just killing the sky. As the representative said before, it's nice to see the stars. Fortunately, I can still see the stars up at my house, because I live on 5 acres and I'm up 1,300 feet. But still, it's mostly a western or a southern view that I have to see the stars. If I start going east, it gets really tough. So, I don't know, being as I'm just a beginner at this, I don't know what to say other than that. I'll get better at it, I guess.
Appreciate your story. Let's go ahead and hear from Mr. McCarthy and then see if there are any follow-up questions for either.
All right. Thank you, Chair Cannon, members of the committee, Brendan McCarthy with PGE. You pulled us up on the beard panel, and I am decidedly deficient in that category. So thank you for giving me an opportunity to speak to you today. Really quick comments. You probably are aware PG is the largest utility in the state. We service over 4,000 square miles of service territory. And in that 4,000 square miles, we have about 181,000 streetlights. Of those 181,000 streetlights, there are sort of three categories of those streetlights. One category is that a municipality or a private entity owns that streetlight and maintains it themselves. That's about 36% of those streetlights. The second category, and it's the biggest category, is the category that a municipality or private entity owns the street lamp and we service the lamp. The last category is, and that's 53%. The last category, if I did my math right, it's about 11% of street lamps that we own, the lamp, and we maintain. So this bill would sort of affect that largest bucket there, that 53% of the 181,000 street lamps. Already, PGE is offering our customers an option for a shielded lamp. So we'll continue to do so under this bill. And I think probably for some of the reasons that Representative Greenlick already mentioned, energy efficiency or just that's what our customers want, we've got those lamps in our inventory. I spoke yesterday with our street lighting specialist who knows street lighting and is a big nerd on street lighting as I am on legislative matters. And she versed me in all sorts of things. And the only little trouble that we had with the bill was that, in her opinion, these lamps don't actually necessarily have to have a covering. And the definition in shielded says that these lamps have a covering. And she said sometimes they're just plain designed that way. There's nothing additional about them. There's no separate sort of shield that goes on top that puts the light down. It's just a factor of the design itself. So I called Representative Greenlick's office, and they quickly prepared an amendment. You'll see the dash ones in front of you, which we just changed, has a covering that ensures to, is designed to ensure. And I think with that, we're completely in support of the bill.
Thank you very much. Questions? Representative Smith from the department.
Aviation. Any impact on commercial or general aviation? And maybe a stupid question, but I know that when you fly at relatively low altitude and you're navigating, sometimes you definitely see streetlights. I don't know. It may have pro or con impacts. Do we know anything about the impact of this on aviation?
I have no.
Chair Cannon, Representative Smith, yeah. I'm not aware that we supply any lamps in that category, so that didn't come up in my conversation.
Are you talking about higher,
Oh, it's just on my mind. We can talk about it after. I don't want to eat up the committee's time too much.
Okay. Representative Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is more of a comment than a question. Maybe it is a question in a way. One of the things that Representative Greenlick mentioned was power saving. It occurs to me that we get power saving in a number of ways, not the least of which is that when the light is properly shielded, all of the light that is generated is directed into the direction that we want the usable light to go in. And if I'm right, then the amount of electricity or the amount of light that needs to be generated is smaller than if you used a globe or an unfocused bulb that went out in all directions. Have I got that right? So that the fact that the light bounces off of a shield and then down to the ground reduces the total amount of light you need to generate or you need to have in that fixture in order to get the same amount of light in the spots where you want.
That's my understanding.
Chair Cannon, Representative Barnhart, yes. I think that's correct.
Thank you. And then a comment, very short comment. It's a wonderful thing when we can get economy, some efficiency, some reduction in energy use, and at the same time improve the quality of life for people. I think the way we want to emphasize this is that like inflating tires properly, small things,
yes,
actually reduce energy use, get us closer to that time when we've made the energy transition from fossil fuels to sustainable energy, and that this is one, over time, simple way of getting there. The other's the bonus. We'll take it, but it's not the reason for doing it.
Agreed. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Oddly enough, we've looked into this over on the eastern part of the state. It may have something to do with the fact that although we have fewer lights, there's no trees to hide them, so you can see them for 20 or 30 miles, and that's really no exaggeration. The question that I encountered when I was looking into shielding of lights was why the manufacturers haven't already designed the shields into the systems, just for the reasons Representative Barnhart just mentioned. Because it seems horribly wasteful to see that light going up and down and all around and not being more often directed by the production of the device. So do either of you know why it is that we seem by default to have these lights that spread light straight up as opposed to down at the target?
You can go first. Chair Cannon, Representative Benz, all I can tell you is what I learned yesterday, which is that they are designing these lights now that do direct them. We've got a history here. As we maintain these lamps and we've got a regular maintenance schedule and we're rotating them in, it's going to take a while to get through the current stock. The mercury vapor lights in the bill is a perfect example. The manufacturers are already beginning to phase them out. We don't install them anymore anyway. So, you're seeing some catch up here that the manufacturers have begun to change.
Follow up, Chair. Do you know the cost difference, these new ones as opposed to the old one?
Chair Cannon, Representative Benz, I do not know the cost difference. I'm sorry, I don't have a good figure for you. I could try and find out if you're interested.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Benz. If you go to the Dark Sky International website, International Dark Sky Association's website, they have a full list of manufacturers that make the acceptable lighting, and there are a lot of manufacturers out there making them now. It's not just a few, so the stuff is available, and I'll agree with this gentleman here. I don't know the cost difference. But I would say over a period of time, the cost difference would be made up by saving the energy.
Thanks very much.
Are the energy saving numbers in the same website?
They don't have hard numbers, sir. But it's a wonderful site. I've got brochures if you people would like to see them. I can leave some with you for more information.
Thank you very much. Thanks. With that, unless there's anybody else who wants to testify, I'm not seeing you do. Come on up, gentlemen. I wasn't sure whether we'd hear from you or not. Briefly, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brady Peeks. I'm with the Oregon Department of Energy. And Representative Greenlick invited us here today to testify on this bill. And I figured my role is primarily for technical questions, and I think I was going to be able to be silent until we had just a couple at the end here. And so I wanted to address Representative Barnhart's question a little bit. And in terms of shielding and energy, and these fixtures are very widely available, the things that we will run into is that some fixtures are not shielded for aesthetic reasons. Some historic districts like the appearance of an old gas light or something like that. And so it's primarily for that reason. And Representative Bence's question kind of follows with the same answer. And the follow-on on that for the energy savings, it depends on the fixture how much energy savings are possible. It really becomes a matter of lighting design and how much of a cutoff angle that we're looking for. Some fixtures have what's called a 90-degree cutoff angle so that it projects light 45 degrees out on either side, which means you need more fixtures, and you could wind up having actually more energy use in that circumstance. But others with the 180-degree cutoff and a quality reflector in them can actually result in a significant energy savings. The thing I was actually expecting the committee might bring up was, since the Section 3 prohibits the sale of high-intensity discharge mercury vapor lights, what the environmental impact of outlawing those might be. And this was just a very cursory check of literature for the industry, in that I haven't really studied mercury vapor lights for about a decade now. We don't see a whole lot of them anymore. But in looking at the comparison to modern compact fluorescent technology, which would be the typical replacement for a mercury vapor lamp, looks like it's about a third the mercury in a compact fluorescent to a high-intensity discharge mercury vapor, and probably about half the energy use. So for the homeowner going to the local home improvement store, no longer choosing the mercury vapor light that might be on sale for $25, $27, choosing the compact fluorescent light where the lamp is going to run about $10 and going with basically a sheet metal shielded exterior type fixture, which I'm just going to guess, and so $15, $20 at most, probably for your bottom end. Not a significant cost increase to the consumer, but definitely an environmental improvement.
Yeah. Great. Thanks very much.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Long. I'm the Administrator of State Building Codes. Just for background, we adopt the state building codes in Oregon, including the energy standards and building codes. And one of the unique pieces in Oregon is that when we adopt standards, they become statewide. They actually preempt local jurisdictions from adopting a standard that's different than what we have at the state level. I just want to make a few comments on some potential operational consequences that may occur, and I do not believe it's the intent. I want to be clear, our organization doesn't have any problem with what we're intending to do, but a couple things for the committee to consider. We currently don't regulate landscape lighting and street lighting in a lot of areas, and searchlights and spotlights and those kinds of things, and it's potential that puts us under the tent of the building code. And when you do that, then there becomes inspections and permits and regulation, and I don't think folks are looking to do that, and we'd want to make sure that that doesn't happen. The other thing in Section 5, which is most of the area that I would be involved in, it is possible that this would preempt other standards that the jurisdictions are already using. The language is a little confusing, and we haven't quite sorted that out, but we want to make sure that's not an outcome, because many cities already adopt very aggressive lighting standards for that have these types of requirements in them, and we wouldn't want to. Eugene has one as an example, Representative Barnhart, and we would not want to create a situation where I overwrite that for some reason because of the state preemption pieces. And then the other thing that we might want to think about, because this would be part of the building code, at least in the Section 5 areas, building codes are, the standards are set by the state, but they're implemented at the local level through local inspectors, and it might be a challenge if inspectors thought that they had to figure out what the cost issues were and make those decisions based on that fixture isn't the right fixture. We think there isn't a cost savings there, and we want you to have a different fixture. So I guess my recommendation would be, if we want to prohibit, if you will, general term, unshielded lights, let's be very specific. I can make that happen in the building code and then not impact other areas of the law. And I think that that's, listening to the representative's testimonies, kind of the intent from the building code's perspective. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Yeah, just to clarify, Mr. Long, were you saying that this bill as it's written would subject these fixtures to permits and inspections, or that it might?
It might. Mr. Chair, the bill's kind of confusing. I've read it multiple times. We have our staff attorneys reading it, and we all have different opinions about what it might do. And so from an operational standpoint, that makes me nervous about implementation after I'm gone and others that don't understand what the good representative is trying to accomplish. But currently, we do not have standards for and regulate searchlight spotlights. We regulate things on buildings. Okay, and we regulate lights in private property. We don't regulate street lights in the right of way and up and down I-5. Obviously, others do that. We don't do landscape lighting, controlled searchlights, those kinds of things. So, if you ask me, and because the definition that I'd write standards for includes outdoor lighting fixtures, some have argued in my organization that now I would be regulating those devices, and I don't particularly want to do that, nor do I think that's the intent. So I'd want to get that clarified, and then the other pieces that I talked about.
Great.
Okay.
Well, I'll suggest that you in particular work with Representative Greenlick and his staff on clarifying, since it sounds like the underlying intent here is one that you wouldn't have any problem with.
That's correct.
I hope there's a way we can move forward and take up this bill in very short order.
Okay.
Thank you both very much. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3367. And let's open a public hearing on, let me get my list. Yeah. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3090 and ask my legislative assistant, Christy Split, and anyone who you want to bring up, Christy. We have another energy efficiency bill here.
Mm-hmm. You're going after gated communities. Nasty guy.
I don't dare. Talking about whether we would cut you off, whether I would cut you off after 3 minutes. It's very brief.
Good afternoon, Chair Cannon and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christy Split, and I am
indeed legislative aide to Representative Ben Cannon. I bring to you today House Bill 3090, a bill that addresses both energy independence and personal freedom. I hope that we can all agree that energy conservation is a good thing. This bill gets to the heart of that conservation, allowing more Oregonians to save energy and money by drying their clothes in the Oregon sunshine. We have people with us today that can tell some of the stories behind this bill and also talk about why it is so important. But I wanted to take a quick moment to go over the bill itself. Please note that I will be speaking to the Dash 3 amendments. You should have them with you on the dais. These amendments essentially replace the original bill. The only significant change, though, is the area of statute which is being affected by the bill. Under current law, the bylaws for homeowners associations and planned and condominium communities, known as CC&Rs, can prohibit the use of clotheslines. They cannot, however, prohibit solar panels. This bill amends the statute protecting the use of solar panels in three ways. On page one of the Dash 3s, you'll see that the current definition of solar energy system is changed in order to include clotheslines. On the bottom of page one and the top of page two, you'll see that prohibitions on and restrictions reducing the effectiveness of solar energy systems are banned. Finally, starting on page two, you'll see provisions for removing such prohibitions and restrictions that are already in CC&Rs laid out. In a time when energy conservation and energy independence are being encouraged at all levels of government, and for good reason, establishing a right to dry is the right thing to do. Thank
right.
you.
Thank you very much. Let's hear from the others here and then take questions.
Chair Cannon and members of the committee, my name is Eli Spivak. I live in Portland, Oregon, and I'm a developer. I've developed a few condo projects in Portland and Corvallis, and in the projects I've done, I've always axed out various restrictions on residents in terms of the solar energy devices. I didn't have that term for it at the time, and I started realizing that I was always receiving boilerplate from attorneys that always had those restrictions in place, and I started wondering how prolific that is. And in talking with attorneys and other developers, I've realized that, yeah, probably like 75% or so of associations have similar rules like that. And I got concerned because that means that Oregonians living in these places, and there are at least 1,000 condos in the state, and that doesn't include all the planned communities. All those Oregonians on a sunny day are unable to, like, use the breeze and the sun to dry their clothes. So instead, they have to use a washer and use the dryer, which is the second highest energy use appliance in the house next to the fridge. Fire danger, there's a lot of issues with that. And it costs money, too. And it seems a little absurd to me. So I did a little more research and actually talked to one attorney friend who, in his own development, he didn't knock out that language. 2 years later, he's living there. One of his neighbors points out that he's hanging his clothes out to dry. And it wasn't an objection to the practice based on aesthetics. It was just like we're sort of a rule-following culture here. And people said, you know, that's what the rule says. And he was the one who wrote it. and then, so you would think that they would change it. But the practice is that it's a pain in the butt to change. I'm sorry. to change those rules. You have to go through a vote of the association, then you have to pay the state Oregon real estate agency to review the change, pay them by the hour to do that. Then you have to wait a review time, then you have to pay to record it at the county. Most associations are not going to go through that practice. So on the ground, people will continue following these rules, even though it means you can't dry your clothes on a sunny day. So I think it's... I've looked into a little bit more. It's not a property value issue. There's been no study showing that there's a linkage of this kind of rule with the reduction of property values. And subjectively, just living in Portland, some of the most esteemed high-profile neighborhoods like Lowellhurst, Goose Hollow, Irvington, those don't have any CC&Rs because they were developed before that age came about, and they're just doing just fine. And I have to say I'm a realist, I'm a developer, so I've probably been a little bit too nettlesome and sort of looking at the actual language of the law to make sure it works well on the ground. And I'll close by saying it's just such a simple thing to use the sun and the breeze to dry your clothes, heat your water. They've been doing it for thousands of years, and to generate electricity. And all that stuff can happen on a household level. And it's just sort of like creating your own carbon offsets rather than buying them from someone else somewhere else. And I think that Oregonians should have a chance to do that. Most Oregonians already can, but those people living in certain communities are not allowed to. And in these cash-strapped times, I think that we should let people have that choice.
Thank you very much.
Chair Cannon, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Susan Taylor. I am from Bend, Oregon, and I am absolutely thrilled to be here to be discussing this bill. This whole debacle of wanting to dry my clothes outside started in May of 2007, and I was listening to National Public Radio to Professor Mary Wood from the University of Oregon, and she was talking about the narrow window of opportunity that we have to respond to the global warming crisis. And that hit real hard because I had just gotten back from spending 5 days camping in the Alvord Desert, which is in a very remote section of southeast Oregon with no light pollution. It's wonderful. And so I had a lot of laundry to do when I got home. And after hearing Professor Mary Wood, I was very depressed. I was bummed, but I thought there is no way that I cannot take some kind of action to respond to this. So it was real clear to me. I hung up a clothesline, and I knew very well it was against the CCNRs, and that in the back of my mind I thought, well, this is going to create some interesting outcomes because I live in a very it's an upscale neighborhood. We purchased the property knowing full well, and we signed on the dotted line with compliance to the CCNRs. My husband and I specifically mentioned clotheslines because the first property I ever bought in Bend, first thing I did was I hung a clothesline. So I thought, well, you know, this will be okay. So to kind of condense what all has aspired since then, it was a week or two after getting home from camping, and I continued to hang my clothes out. My neighbor thought, well, I was just catching up on laundry, but when they continued to be hung out, I got a phone call from the developer, and it wasn't to applaud me for my efforts in to conserve energy and decrease emissions. They told me pretty much the clotheslines had to come down. And I said, you know, are you aware of global warming, that there is an energy crisis, and that there's a bigger picture than responding to your outdated CCNRs that were written back in 1984? That's 25 years ago. So I continued to hang my clothes out, and I submitted formal letters, a number of formal letters to the developer requesting the urgent need to respond to the crisis at hand with global warming and our energy, our gluttonous energy consumption. And their response was, it didn't go anywhere. And as I continued to hang my clothes out, I was threatened with legal action from the developer, and I have multiple letters that continue to threaten me with legal action, which totally got my attention because their pockets are a lot deeper than mine. So at that point, I tried to meet their compliance, which meant that my clotheslines needed to be screened. We live in a corner lot. It made it very difficult to screen my clothes. So my first screening device, failed.
Passing them around.
Yeah. And then after that first screening device method failed, I resorted to the garage. So I hung my clothes in the garage, and promptly after hanging the clothes in the garage, I got a phone call from the developer telling me that my garage doors need to be down. I totally lost it at that point. I became very angry. My neighbors who to the north of me, it became very apparent that that's where that phone call came from, that complaint. And we don't need to go into details. I was lucky that they were running a vacuum cleaner at the time so that they didn't hear my expletives. So I continue to be compliant. And then I went to the internet, and I'm thinking, I'm not the only person that can be having this problem, because 20% of Americans live in subdivisions that either prohibit or restrict the use of clotheslines to conserve energy. And sure enough, via the web, I ended up getting in contact with Anne Marie Shaker. She is a Wall Street Journal reporter, and within a very short period of time of having telling her my story, she flew out from New York within about 2 days of our initial conversation, and she started interviewing my neighbors and myself, including the CEO of the developing company. And to make a long story short, I ended up on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, as well as it ballooned out into not only a local and national level, but it went international, because there was a filming crew that flew out from New York for ARD, which is a German television news program, and I ended up in the German newspaper. But so after that point... we put our house on the market for sale because it was obvious to our family that this was not a good fit for us. And about the same time, I requested the development company to put this clothesline issue to a vote. They refused to do that. I asked for a list of the property owners with their addresses so that I could take some action. They refused to do that as well. The last communication I have had from the development company was they had received multiple phone calls, apparently over a period of a couple of months, and they were wondering, the residents and property owners were wondering why I continued to hang my clothes against the CCNRs. And I was very brief and to the point, and I said, with our current economic, energy, and environmental crisis, it has never made more sense to be hanging my clothes out to dry. I continue to hang my clothes out to dry because it is the right thing to do. And I guess that's what I'm asking with supporting this bill. It is absolutely... beyond my comprehension how we can find a fence in clothes billowing in the breeze when our planet is suffering as a result of our gluttonous use of continued energy usage and spewing CO2 emissions into the air. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for sharing your story, Susan. And let's see if there are questions for any of these panelists. Representative Bernhardt.
Thank you. I've read the -3 amendment, and I'm not certain that I understand what it actually does. Does it remove the prohibition on existing properties that are subject to it now? Or does it have a future effect of some kind, or both?
It does both. I'm going to get my copy of the -3 so I can walk you through it. But if you look on the second page, you'll see that line four says a provision in an instrument is void and unenforceable if the provision violates, and then it gives a list. And the reason that it says subsection A and then subsection B is that the original law that protects solar panels was passed or went into effect on October 3rd of 1979. And since we expanded the definition of solar energy systems, we basically just kept that date. So if there was something in before 1979, then that would be subject to the what happens on line 10, which sets up a petitioning mechanism to move something off. And then this is my understanding from talking to our bill drafter. On line 8, it talks about subsection 2B. And this is something new that we did with this bill, which originally the bill just said you cannot prohibit solar panels or solar energy systems. But now we're saying you can't restrict the orientation or use in a manner that impairs the effective operation. So that's something new, which is why that has the later date. Does that make sense?
If I may.
Yeah, go ahead, Philip.
It does, but I don't understand, if it's intended to deal with existing facilities, why you would have a start date on it. I mean, it looks to me as though, are we dealing with the future impairment of the orientation of solar energy systems only, or does it affect existing solar energy systems that may already be impaired? in their orientation?
My understanding from talking to our bill drafter is that the provisions laid out for getting rid of something that's already in the bylaws is there to address both the things that are already in the bylaws, but we're also saying you can't do it in the future. I'm sorry if I'm not answering your question.
If I may, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
So the sub 4 on line 10 is the one that deals with existing restrictions. Is that right?
Chair Cannon, Representative Barnhart. I think that is right, yes.
Okay. All right. The dates were just simply puzzling to me, Mr. Chair. That's all.
It is confusing.
Chair Cannon, Representative.
I think that answers my question.
Okay, good. Yeah, it has to do with the existing statute.
So this, if I may, Mr.
Yep.
Chair, the story we just heard then, in that situation, if this bill were the law now, a homeowner of record of the property who is subject to the provision could file a petition to remove the provision. Under sub 4, lines 10 through 14 on page 2 of this amendment.
Chair Cannon.
And I assume that somewhere in this bill it says that petition has to be granted.
Chair Cannon.
The court has to do this then.
Go ahead. Do you want to take it?
Chair Cannon, Representative Barnhart. Yeah, I think it would go to a court and the court would look at this legislation and look at the clause in the condominium statute or the and make a determination on whether that clause needs to be struck indeed or whether the petitioner is erroneous.
And most of these are deed covenants, aren't they? Restrictions on the deed in some form.
Yeah, either through a declaration or bylaws.
Of course, in a
right.
condominium.
Right, in that environment.
Right.
Yeah, or it could be a deed if it was a property conveyance. Yeah.
Right.
And then for projects going forward, every year I get a couple, like a list of statements from the real estate agency saying these are the new rules in terms of condominium documents, and this would just be one of the batch saying that for new documents, you can't have languages making these restrictions.
Thank you. That covers my questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Boone.
Thank you. And I didn't know if I'd heard Susan say this or not, but did you do a poll of the owners in your condominiums and see if they would agree to change this ruling rather than come to the state for this?
This isn't a condominium. It is of a development over, I don't know how many square miles. There's probably 800 homes, and those lots are about a half acre to an acre large, and so it's a huge development. But I did informally go out, and I would, I had my little flyers and saying, you know, what do you feel about this? Do you think it's a good idea? And I got a whole lot of support from just my informal asking of people that lived up there whether or not they thought it was a reasonable thing to be able to have access to solar and wind to dry clothes without screening them. And it was overwhelmingly for that.
Follow up. What is the procedure for changing this covenant or whatever it is?
Republican Boone, or Representative Boone, I'm sorry. The procedure right now, since they refused to put the clothesline issue specifically to a vote, what the developer ended up doing was getting a vote from all the property owners, and it has now been turned over to a homeowners association, and that just took place January 1st, 2009. And so now there's a board that is made up of 5 individuals that will be the holders of that contract. They will be the ones to determine what happens from this point onward. What I am strongly requesting is that the state of Oregon pass legislation to allow any energy conservation device, including clotheslines and solar panels, so that we can stop this crisis that we're in to be able to save money. The other point I want to make is that a lot of people cannot afford solar panels. Most people can afford the very simple device of a clothesline and clothespins, and it just makes sense. But I don't want to have to be the one that petitions to in order to get permission to do this. I would like to see legislation that allows this to take place and includes it is retroactive as well.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We're going to hear from a couple of more folks on this bill and then move on to our final bill. So thank you, and I hope you'll stick around. Michelle Poirot and Katie Daly and Kelly Ross to finish off this bill. Do you want to begin, Ms. Poirot?
Yes. Good afternoon, Chair Cannon and members of the committee. My name is Michelle Poirot. I'm a resident of Portland as well. I'm here to ask for your support in House Bill 3090. I, as Representative Barnhart said about the last bill in question about lighting, I was very excited to think that I could make a small investment and a small change and actually save quite a bit of energy. And I was thinking about drying my laundry. So I went to IKEA and I bought this beautiful multi-layered wire rack that folds up perfectly flat and slides behind my dresser when I don't need it. And I told my neighbor how excited I was about it and that I would open the bay windows in my bedroom and put it there. And she said, oh, shoot, but you can't do that because the bylaws of our associations say that clothing or laundry shall not be hung in doorways or windows so as to be visible to persons outside of the building. Now, I live in a row house development. It's a very nice development. I love it there, and we have an excellent homeowners association. Part of the reason it's excellent is it's a very conservative group. They don't like allowing people to fudge the rules at all, and that actually creates a really nice living environment. But it does mean that even though most of the people in my homeowners association, I think, would be happy to dry their laundry in view of the street, maybe even to install clotheslines in some of the areas of the development, they really prefer that we not fudge the rules in that department because they don't want that to happen in other departments, and I think that's a very good approach. Now, one of the nuances of my row house rules is that the common areas where you might install a solar panel or a clothesline, those are common areas, so that's the roof or the walls. These are row houses. So what this bill would not change is it would not allow someone in my development to install a solar panel on the roof or bolt a clothesline into the wall and run it across the driveway to someone else's wall. All of those things would still have to be approved by the board of directors, which is very important, of course, because those are commonly supported amenities. We all pay for the roof, we all pay for the walls, so that wouldn't change. The simple thing that would change is that people could dry their laundry in their windows or on their balconies. Now, I think it's a very good question why we wouldn't just change our bylaws. It's just one paragraph in the bylaws. 2 years after this development was put in place in 1999, there was a bylaws change for something very important, and that was how to collect on non-payment of dues. It was a total pain in the neck. Once you open up the bylaws for change, everybody has an idea about a little thing they want to change also. So while this is pretty important to my neighbors and everyone, I think, would appreciate it and not have a problem with it, it's definitely not worth the trouble of changing the bylaws, which is a very long process. So I would really encourage you to support House Bill 3090. It will allow me to take my lovely IKEA rack out from behind my dresser, open my windows, and dry my clothes in the windows instead of in the hall where it takes a couple of days. It would also allow my homeowners association to start having a discussion about whether or not we want to put clotheslines in someplace or solar panels in someplace, and we can have that discussion based on the merits of the project and the installation and not be turned away simply by this provision in our bylaws that prohibits it outright. So thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you on this issue today, and I hope that it can be resolved quickly. Thank you.
Thanks for being here. Thanks for your testimony. Katie?
Good afternoon, Chair Cannon, members of the committee. My name is Katie Daly, and today I'm speaking on behalf of myself. I'm a private citizen who's very passionate about drying my clothes, line drying. I really applaud Susan Taylor's ability to garner international media for something that I think is really important. I want to find out how she can do that. I actually was in Minneapolis reading an article in the Minneapolis paper about her when the incident happened, and I was just actually embarrassed and shocked that it was something that happened. I'd lived in Bend previously, and that it happened in Bend. And I was wondering who you know, was actually opposed to line drying. You know, it's motherhood and apple pie. In fact, I think the biggest irony of this is detergent commercials and other types of fabric softener commercials all are represented by people running through a field with the sheets in the wind, lying, you know, on their line drying, and yet, you know, so many people are not able to do that. It just seems like really ironic to me that we'd have to buy a chemical in a bottle in order to be able to get what we can get for free. Turns out the people that were opposed to it, that were quoted in the article, were the American Appliance Association, and for obvious reasons that they were opposed to it, but their biggest statistic that they cited was the fact that line drying your clothes causes more allergens to be in your clothes, and that it's actually a health hazard to hang your laundry out to dry. And then obviously the realtors were opposed to it because they said this brought down house values, and that was what really offended me. I think that making a characterization on something that people, you know, I mean, it's not always easy to line dry your clothes. You actually have to take more time. You have to go out and do it. But you're doing it for a number of reasons. Mostly, the reason I do it is to save energy and to, you know, take advantage of the natural resources that we have instead of having to dry your clothes. And it just was amazing to me that this is a problem. It turns out the more I looked into it, across the country, it really, really is a problem. And it's just Susan was able to get the media around it, but I think a lot of people who aren't as savvy of calling the Wall Street Journal are discovering the problems of being able to do something that we all should be able to do. I have some statistics in my testimony that's kind of interesting. Dryers are typically the second most electricity-intensive appliance in the home after the refrigerator. They make an estimated 10 to 25% of residential electricity use in the average year. The average family can save over $85 a year by using a clothesline instead of a dryer. And over its typical 18-year lifetime, an electric dryer costs approximately $1,530 to operate. That's on today's electricity dollars. That probably will go up over time. And 1 year's use of a household clothes dryer generates about 150 kilograms of carbon dioxide. So the savings are really real. We're spending a lot of money in this state on residential tax credits to get people to use appliances that use less energy. And here we have the opportunity for people to actually get rid of an appliance altogether, or at least decrease their use of it quite a bit when the sun allows. Also, I thought it was interesting here. This is kind of a confluence of all of these bills that you've heard today. I was thinking that Commissioner Leonard could probably speak to this point. There's also little-known safety implications with dryer usage. In an average year, residential clothes dryers in the U.S. cause 12,700 fires, 15 deaths, 300 injuries, and $116 million in property damage. So it's also a public safety issue, I think, as well.
If you finish up.
Yep, I just want to encourage you to support this bill. It was just something that just struck me when I read about it a couple years ago, and I think we at the state of Oregon should do what we can to make it easier for people to reduce their carbon footprint. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kelly Ross, and I come before you today representing the Community Associations Institute and the Oregon-Washington Community Association Managers. As you may be aware, there's actually tens of thousands of community associations in Oregon. They fall into two categories: a homeowners association formed under ORS Chapter 94, which is usually a residential subdivisions, detached single-family homes, or row houses in a linear orientation. And then there's the condo owners associations that are formed under Chapter 100 that are more of a vertical nature. For each of these associations, they are a registered corporation, most with elected board of directors, and their charge is to manage and maintain the structures in the association. For single-family homes, that usually entails the common areas, playgrounds, what have you. For row houses, the common walls are owned by the association. And in condos, virtually the entire structure is owned by the association. The owners actually only own the airspace within those buildings. So I've heard concern from the folks in our associations about the impact that this would have on maintenance of the common areas. I take a slightly different interpretation from the first witness, that my reading of the Dash 3 amendments is that it would go around the elected condo board and allow individual owners to install structures in common areas, racks, the like. So I'm certainly a big fan of clothes dried in the great outdoors, but I think we want to be careful about costs that may be imposed on other owners of a structure for when there are maintenance problems. What we're really seeing and are concerned about in recent years has been water intrusion into these buildings, and any time you do affix a new apparatus or structure or mechanism to the outside of a building and have to penetrate the skin of that building, there's a high potential for water intrusion. So we'd certainly be willing to work with you on amendments to address our concerns, and I apologize for not making contact earlier with you and your staff on the bill.
Well, I appreciate you being here today, and if I understood you correctly, it sounds like you want to be careful to assure that this bill doesn't impact the ability of the association to properly maintain the commonly owned areas.
Correct.
And I think that's the intention of the bill as well. We're interested in allowing owners, homeowners or condo owners, to use the space that they own that's not common space for this purpose, but not to impede access to or, you know, common ownership of the common space.
Correct.
So I appreciate that, and we'll see if we can find a way to work that issue out. Are there any questions? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here. I want to ask you a question. Before I do, I was telling Representative Barnhart, and he agreed, we grew up, you know, with families that hung their clothes out to dry. We didn't have a dryer. A neighbor got a dryer. I was about 10. Big deal. And so we went over to inspect. They had fewer safety measures then. And I talked the little girl whose dryer it was into going for a ride in the dryer. And I was not invited back. But I guess the way I want to start my question is this. Would you all support federal legislation for this?
Chair Cannon, Representative Gilliam, absolutely I would. I can only speak for myself. You know, clotheslines don't have to be obtrusive. Mine looks like a leash that you unroll and roll up, and I just don't see any reason why we shouldn't be actually advocating for this nationwide.
Mm-hmm. You have a follow-up question? Or, go ahead.
Chair Cannon, Representative Gilliam, I also would support federal legislation. I think what's good for Oregon is probably also good for the rest of the country. It would be great if we can lead on this issue.
And Chair Cannon, Representative Gilliam, I think we would support or certainly consider federal legislation if it was responsive to the concerns we've had on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I suspected that you would, and you all spoke, you know, from different angles. I just don't think it rises to that level. I don't think it rises to the level here in the state. And I really am concerned that we open a can of worms getting involved in CCNRs around the state. What I do like is the generation of media attention, and I, too, admire our guest today. And I think the media attention, in terms of awareness, in terms of, you know, hello, you could hang your clothes up, I think is great. But it's common sense. I know there are issues with CCNRs. But for us as a state right now, any time really, to involve ourselves in local, talk about local control and local government, I think is very unwise.
Thank you for the comments. Representative Bernhardt.
Thank you. Very, very quickly. I hadn't thought of the issue of involving common walls and common areas until the witness brought it up. Looking at the bill, it is very sweeping in the way it's drafted. I would have no problem or no concern about adding a section that clarified that this was not intended to interfere with the owners' association's capacity to manage and maintain common walls and common areas, and it was not intended to allow an owner to invade common areas in order to accomplish these purposes. I'm familiar with the with disconnected private homes being surrounded by common area, and it's not obvious unless you actually look at the plat where the land that belongs to the homeowner ends and the common area begins. And certainly it was not my thought that we would allow a homeowner to put one of their clothesline stakes out into the common area.
That's right.
Nor to allow a condominium owner to breach the fabric of the building or otherwise interfere with neighbors by interfering with moisture protection requirements. So I think a clarification in the statute might be a good idea.
Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chair, may I make a point that I don't think has been brought up? Thank you. I think the reason this is happening in part is that shouldn't say most. In the case of my development, the developer put together the bylaws, sold off every unit, and had nothing to do with it anymore. So he had no incentive to write the laws thinking about how they would actually operate. And that also means that every development he does afterwards, he isn't getting the message that this is problematic. So unfortunately, it doesn't even rise to his level to change. Now, Mr. Spivak is changing it because I think he's particularly conscientious about this, and also because he's lived in one of his own developments. But this doesn't rise to the level of developers making changes if they're planning on selling off their developments when they're done, which most of them, I think, are. So that's why we would really appreciate leadership from the state in helping the developers see that it is an impact.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Representative Boone.
I'd be remiss if I didn't bring this up. I was asked early on in my legislative career to interfere in a local CC&R in Cannon Beach. And let me tell you, it was not a can of worms. It was a 55-gallon drum of worms. And it is my understanding that when you buy into these places, it's very clear. I looked at this person's packet, it was pretty thick, of the CC&Rs, and it clearly stated, and they clearly signed and initialed every page, five of the complaints they had, and there was really nothing we could do short of going to the courts, but you can't save some people from themselves. And if you are going to move into a place that has these limitations on your what you can do there, then you go into it, I would assume, knowing that in the first place, and that would either stop you or not.
Representative Bernhardt.
Thank you. CC&Rs are already highly regulated. They have many restrictions already placed on them. There are deed restrictions on older properties primarily, which are considered to be illegal because of their violation of racial covenants and things of that sort. Some of them may be in deeds of properties that some people on the committee own, but they're not enforceable because of the rules. Making this kind of a change is a relatively easy, small, unimportant thing to do. Certainly, for an individual to change a covenant contained in a very large set of bylaws, rules administered by a homeowners association is extremely difficult. For us to put a restriction in place that has the same effect is much easier. And it is not at all unusual for states to do that. That would not be a reason why I would be at all concerned about making this change.
Representative Smith, and then we really need to move on, but last word, Representative.
I'd apologize because I will say I'm echoing. CC&Rs are how we segregated areas. That's how we did it. It's different than that. I acknowledge it's different than that, but I hold them far different from sacrosanct. In fact, it was the primary tool of racism, one of the primary tools of racism in this country, to think that they are somehow, you know, Bibles from on high is contrary to the truth. Second, I just want to say, as it respects the individual purchaser and economic actor in the transaction, which I think is worth respecting, we are talking about behavior that impacts everybody. This is not merely how our use of energy doesn't merely impact ourselves and the other livers within the other dwellers in a development. It impacts all of us. We're recognizing more and more how much our energy use is impacting everybody economically and environmentally. So I think this is the kind of place where we can do a little thing to go a long ways to deregulate and have a positive public interest advantage.
Thank you, and thanks very much to the folks who, some of you came some distance to be here, and appreciate you doing that.
Thank you.
With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3090 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2795. We have three people signed up to testify, and the three of you can come on up and get started in any order. You've been very patient, as has the remaining members of this committee. You know our schedule. I trust you'll be able to be brief. Thank you.
Do you want me to start?
Go ahead.
Okay. Chair Cannon, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Renee Hackenmiller-Paradis. I am the Environmental Health Program Director at Oregon Environmental Council. Oregon Environmental Council supports House Bill 2792. This would require that all diesel school buses in Oregon are either retrofitted by 2017 or replaced by 2025. And what this essentially does is that buses between 1994 and 2006 would be retrofitted. Those are the ones that are technologically able to be retrofitted. In my testimony, I provided information on retrofitting. I'm not going to cover that now. And then this would require that pre-94 buses be replaced, diesel school buses. We believe that reducing diesel emissions from school buses represents one of the most important opportunities to achieve rapid and cost-effective health and environmental benefits in Oregon. And just briefly, I want to talk about some of the health impacts of diesel. Diesel emissions have been linked to increased risk of cancer, heart disease, impaired neurological development, and pulmonary disorders. Diesel emissions contain high levels of particulate matter and other air toxins, and even at low levels, these contaminants exacerbate or cause asthma and other respiratory ailments. Children are especially susceptible to diesel emissions because they breathe 50% more air per pound of body weight than adults, as well as having narrow airways and immature immune systems. So how are they getting exposed in diesel buses? There are currently more than 3,700 diesel-powered school buses in Oregon, and approximately 70% of these buses have not been retrofitted, and they're unnecessarily emitting hazardous diesel exhaust. Diesel exhaust exposure is especially high for children who ride buses. Diesel emissions can enter buses through a hole in the crank case. Thank you, Steve. Or through tailpipe emissions. And studies have found that within air bus concentrations of particulate matter and air toxins can be 4 to 12 times higher than ambient levels. And those retrofits would fix that crank case portion there. In addition, emissions from idling buses lined up outside schools concentrate pollution within schoolyards and schools themselves, resulting in exposures from non-bus riding children also. So what does this mean about children's health? A major health challenge in Oregon is childhood asthma, and diesel exhaust is a key aggravating factor in the soaring rates of asthma throughout our state. Diesel exhaust can increase both the frequency and severity of asthma attacks and may lead to inflammation of the airways that can cause or worsen asthma. There's an estimated 73,000 Oregon school children that now suffer from asthma. And children suffering from asthma not only have to deal with the daily health challenges, but many studies have shown that these children have higher school absentee rates, possibly translating into poor performance in school. And I just want to talk real briefly about this recent report from Washington, which really highlights what these diesel retrofits can do. So a recent report from Washington State, they looked at school districts that had implemented diesel retrofits within their school districts. They retrofitted about 25% of their school buses, and they saw a 23 to 31% reduction in children hospital admissions due to asthma attacks. And that's significant, a 25 to 30% reduction in hospitalizations due to asthma just from retrofitting 25% of their school buses. And that was a nice controlled study because there was also districts that did not retrofit and they did not see those significant declines. And then also the school retrofitting school districts also experienced 36 to 39% reductions in pneumonia and other types of pulmonary disorders. So what does this mean for healthcare costs? According to a 2008 price of pollution report that we wrote, childhood asthma cost Oregonians $27.7 million per year in direct and indirect healthcare costs. So based on these estimates and using the Washington State report studies, a 23% statewide decrease in asthma-related healthcare costs translates into a savings of more than $5 million per year for the state. And then the Washington State study concluded that even excluding potential benefits to adults with chronic conditions and omitting suffering considerations, they saw the cost-benefit ratio of more than 20 to 1 for retrofitting school buses.
Diesel exhaust also contributes to regional haze problems, contaminates soil and water, and contributes to global warming from the emission of black carbon particles. Many school districts in Oregon are already aggressively retrofitting or replacing their school buses. But despite this progress, there are still many buses throughout the state that need to be retrofitted or replaced. Currently, there are 250 diesel school buses in Oregon that need to be replaced. They're pre-94, and approximately 2,500 remain to be retrofitted. There are a variety of sources to help schools facilitate the needed fixes, including state and federal grant programs and supplemental environmental protection funds, penalty funds for environmental infractions, which Lane County is actually currently using to retrofit and replace their diesel school buses. We believe the time frame outlined in HB 2792 enables the schools the opportunity to identify funding sources while ensuring that retrofitting or replacing the current fleet of diesel buses continues to be a priority. Thank you for your time and consideration of this important legislation.
Thank you very much.
Okay. For the record, my name is Stephen Hewlett. I'm the director of the Pupil Transportation for Fingerprinting Section for the Department of Education, and we are in charge of the school buses. And, of course, we are also concerned for the safety and the health of the students on our school buses. And so I'm here to support this bill. You know, I think you also got a fiscal impact. Just to give you a little clarification maybe on that, you did not receive one?
Where it must still be in process.
Okay. When you see that, you're going to see, you know, some numbers. But one thing you need to look at is the regular replacement of school buses that is currently going on. We're replacing between 300 and 400 school buses each year that school districts already do. So between now and 2017, as far as how much increase as far as fiscal, it's going to be very minimal. And as far as those older buses, you know, at the time of 2025 comes around, they're going to be 31 years old. We're going to hope that they have gone away by then, you know, because they probably are, you know, there's other parts of the bus that are probably is much more unsafe than the exhaust coming out of the engines as far as structural strength-wise. So we would support this, and I'm here basically for any questions you may have dealing with numbers of school buses and things like that. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, 43,000 classified and certified educators throughout the state, including thousands of school bus drivers. We also are here in support of House Bill 2795 for all the reasons that you've heard. We've been working on the issue of clean diesel in school buses for several years now. We were strong proponents of House Bill 2172 that moved through this body in 2007. We've worked with DEQ in the interim since then to implement that bill, and we're back here to make some fine tweaks on it. And this is what I consider House Bill 2795 to be, as a fine tweak. We initially came to the legislature with the intention of providing a bill that would require school districts to establish a school bus replacement policy with a maximum 15-year retention period. This is longer than than industry standard for school buses, and would encapsulate school buses into the time frame that the National Transportation Safety Board uses when they update their safety standards for school buses. In Oregon, we have districts, because of the difficulty we have in funding schools, we have districts who sometimes forget that their school buses need to be replaced regularly. Our state transportation grant provides a refund to districts for their school bus purchases, but they often don't think about that when they're trying to get rid of 40, you know, reduce the number of kids in a classroom. So that's what we were trying to do. We will be back next session with that bill. We couldn't get it done in this bill. And in the meantime, this bill will provide, I think, some mild emphasis for school districts that they do need to get rid of these old buses. But as Mr. Hewlett said, we do not believe that there will be any significant impact on school districts by this bill, because these buses are being replaced in sufficient numbers that the oldest buses that can't be retrofitted will probably be gone anyway by the time this date is done. So please pass the bill today. You still have time to do it today if you'd like to.
If only we had all our paperwork.
If only you did, Mr. Chair.
At a quorum, I guess we had that.
Questions, Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a great bill, and I was wondering if you'd accept a friendly amendment to add safety belts to those buses while they're being replaced.
I'd be interested in hearing your response.
Well, let me start. I'm sure Steve has some ideas, too. Mr. Chair and Representative Boone, the NTSB and NHTSA are looking at the issue of school buses, seatbelts in school buses, and they've just issued rules requiring seatbelts in the very smallest of the buses, actually smaller buses than we have. So the rule doesn't really apply yet, but they are looking at it. Part of the problem with school buses, with seatbelts in school buses, is that school buses carry 5-year-olds and 18-year-olds, and 3-point school seatbelt systems don't work on 18-year-olds and 5-year-olds, and they are in some cases quite dangerous for children. In addition to that, if there is an accident, a school bus driver with 70 little kids in the bus has a hard time getting 70 kids unbuckled and out of the bus in a timely fashion. And so those are the reasons that the federal government has not required seatbelts in larger school buses up till this point and has instead developed a very effective passive restraint system in the way the buses are designed and the seats are designed to that is actually safer than a school than a seatbelt in protecting a kid in a crash.
Follow up, and this is a longer discussion than today, but having responded to accidents on the highway with a school bus, there is no way when a bus rolls that a kid's going to stay in that seat, and that's not safer. But my point is you could also make certain rows for small kids, certain rows for big kids.
Mm-hmm. Commissioner Barnhart.
Thank you. Do you know what percentage of the ambient particulate matter from diesel output comes from school buses?
Chair Cantor, Representative Barnhart, I don't know the total for school buses.
It's so not the total I'm asking, it's the percentage.
Percentage.
I mean, I'm assuming that most of it comes either from stationary diesel equipment, from farm equipment, or from large trucks that don't carry kids, they carry stuff instead. And that what we're talking about is a relatively small percentage of the diesel particulates, and if you don't know the answer, then let me ask the second question.
Yep.
How are these dates coordinated? Do they have anything at all to do with the phase out of diesel particulates from diesel engines from those other sources that I'm describing, or is it entirely related to the replacement cycle of the buses themselves?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I can give you a bit of information having served on the DEQ committee that implemented 2172 or drafted rules for its implementation. You're correct. School buses do not. I can't give you an exact percentage of the amount of particulate that they contribute to the air. It's not as much as road building equipment and those kinds of things as you mentioned. And so school buses aren't getting the bulk of the funding for retrofitting as a result. However, school buses, by the nature of what they carry, create the particulate emissions create a greater health risk because children as said to you, because they are smaller and their bodies are smaller and they breathe faster,
right.
That
was very clear.
More.
And in fact, there's one more reason that she did not state, and that's simply the fact that they're growing quickly and they're developmentally.
Right.
She mentioned the word immature, but there's a whole variety of other reasons
why
that's true. I wasn't focusing on that so much as the whole issue of how we get the ambient level of diesel particulate matter down.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly understand the point you're making.
There is a very large program that the federal government is implementing to try to retrofit diesel engines and get the most polluting engines out of the environment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Cannon, Representative Barnhart, if I could just make a comment about that. I just want the one thing about particulate matter, though, is it's very localized.
Yes.
And so within a school, on your school grounds, the school buses idling there, they're contributing a significant portion to that local PM concentration. So as a total, they're not as much a high percentage, but within that small environment, they're going to be contributing a lot.
Representative Gilliam.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. We received written testimony from you. Did we?
No.
I apologize. I didn't get your name.
Stephen Hewlett with the Oregon Department of Ed. I'm the Director of Pupil Transportation.
Mr. Hewlett, I got a quick question.
Yes.
If you're on track, and it sounds like you are, and I appreciate it because I appreciate what this does for children, why do we need the bill?
Chair Cannon and Representative Gillum, I think it's just an incentive to get those districts to start ahead of this, to get ahead of the game. You know, there's some, right now there's some stimulus dollars and some federal funds out there that we're really trying to convince districts to take advantage of so that it's easier, of course, on the state budgets, that they take federal dollars, you know, and then they can do even more work than it, with those per dollars as it is. So by pushing this through, I think it's going to incentive them to start working quicker on that bill.
Follow.
Thank you. So, the momentum's there. Is there something specifically about the bill that you think matches up with federal stimulus money, or is it just the idea?
Well, Chair Cannon and Representative Gillum, you know, 2010 is another huge earmark that's going to set for the diesel standards that's coming out, that we call it the postage stamps of diesel, that's even much, you know, it's like 100 times less than what we're doing now. And so that's going to be the next envelope. And, again, the cost of the buses for doing that is going to increase, I'm hearing, $8,000 to $10,000 per bus, or for, you know, engine, depending on over the road, what, on that, at that point. And so if they can do some retrofitting at $7,000 or $8,000, you know, and save the bus, it'll be a cost savings over the time than when working just on the replacement, because with the cost of the bus going and this, you know, the economy we're in right now, we're seeing a little bit decrease in purchases because they just can't afford them. So this will give them some incentive to be able to use that and those federal dollars to help with this, to even make it happen quicker.
Thank you.
I would like to answer, if it's okay, Chair Cannon, to Boone about the seatbelt issue. I just wanted to do a little clarification on the federal law. As of September 1st, 2009, all buses now have, they've raised the height back requirements on school buses, another 4 inches, to make the compartmentalization even more. The bill also includes that all school buses with a GVW 10,000 or less will now have lap shoulder belts installed. We at the NASDIPS department, we actually tried to get that changed to type A buses, which would go up to 14,500, because they're basically the same bus, just a different GVW. We're still working on that, and hopefully that will go through, because that actually doesn't go into place until, I think, 2011, that is a federal law. So there is some movement, and there are also, for those districts or states that want to put seatbelts in their school buses, they've set some standards now written into the federal law that they have to meet to make that happen. Where there wasn't any standards before, now there are some standards for the safety of how those belts and how the seats are designed. And the seat manufacturers are also working very hard to accommodate the 5 years old and the 16-year-olds, and they're making what they call a multi-flex seat that will accommodate both, you know, the 200-pound football kid and the, you know, 60-pound kindergartner. So they're working on it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. 45-pound, maybe. 60. Unlikely. Thank you very much for your testimony.
You're more than welcome. Thank you.
Yeah, that's right.
With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2795 and close the Committee on Environment and Water.
Or you get along.